Here's what you need to know on news today, as the International Golf Federation has confirmed that the International Olympic Committee Executive Board has approved the addition of an Olympic mixed team event, which will debut at the Olympic Games Los Angeles 2028 and complement the men's individual Olympic competition and the women's individual Olympic golf competition. All three Olympic golf events will be contested at Riviera Country Club as part of the LA 28 Games. The mixed team event will be contested as a 36-hole competition, 18 holes of foursomes, a.k.a. alternate shot for the first round, followed by 18 holes of four ball, otherwise known as best ball, for the final round. There will be a maximum of one team per country, with teams comprised of one male and one female who are already qualified for the men's and women's individual Olympic golf competitions. The mixed team event will take place after the four-round men's individual Olympic golf competition and prior to the four-round women's individual golf competition. The addition of the mixed team event marks the first Olympic team golf competition since 1904. So who better to talk with now than we have the International Golf Federation Executive Director Anthony Scanlon on the show. How did this mixed team event finally come to fruition?
Hi, George. Hi, Evan. Yeah, thanks very much. Hard to follow after the fantastic Masters, but it's great news for golf. How did it happen? Well, it's a progression, actually. Back in 2014 at the Youth Olympic Games, we had a mixed team event. In fact, Victor Hovland played in that. And the IOC has always had a philosophy that the Olympic Games can't be a lab rat for events. So we had the vision of having a teams event and a mixed teams event back then. And we've held that mixed team event at the Youth Olympic Games twice. And then after canvassing information, you know, some feedback from the top players, we put an application to the IOC last January. And January of 2024 for this mixed teams event. And last week, the IOC executive board confirmed that they will add that to the program.
Anthony, do they require convincing in any respect? Because it cannot be an easy process to add an event to the Olympics.
We didn't need convincing, but yes, certainly. I think overall, all of the Olympics federations had the opportunity to nominate events. I think there was 85 events that the 28 federations had nominated as additional to, I think, the 325, I think, there were in Paris. And from that list, the IOC whittled it down to effectively 10 extra events, and we were one of those. And we had, you know, fantastic support from the LA Olympic Committee, LA 28 organizing committee. They could see not only the financial benefit of adding two more days to Riviera, but also, you know, the excitement of having such a unique teams event. And when you look at how teams sport, or how teams events in golf are, you know, Ryder Cup, Solheim Cup, how they just capture the imagination of the golf fan, we thought this was, which was a good thing for us to do. And yeah, as I said, the players, after the fantastic atmosphere that they received in Paris, especially on the front tee with all the different nations dressed up in their flags and national dress and et cetera, it gave us more evidence to the IOC that were there during the games that this would be a must have, and fortunately they've seen it that way.
The Olympic Games kind of are 2.5 week competition. To fit both the men's Olympic golf competition, a women's Olympic golf competition, and a mixed team event, from a schedule standpoint, how would that look?
Yeah, so you're right. It's a 16-day event. We will have practice days from Saturday through to Tuesday of the first week of the games. And on the Wednesday now, we will have the men's competition commence. That will continue through to the Saturday, whereas previously we had the traditional Thursday to Sunday start and finish. And then following that, on the Sunday, we'll have, as you said, the foursomes, and then the Monday, the four ball, and that will conclude the mixed team event. And then the women will have, they'll be able to practice around the individual competition as well as the mixed competition, and then they will start their competition on the Wednesday as normal and finishing on the Saturday. Which is great, because that Saturday we've found is a fantastic sweet spot for television and, you know, the audience that is generated for the women's game is equal to, and at times sometimes better than the men's game. So I think we've got a great scheduling point of view from showcasing our sport across the world.
Anticipate, Anthony, that it will be the top-ranked qualifier in each country that represents, or is that going to be more flexible? Are we talking Scottie Scheffler and Nelly Korda to use the current rankings, or is that something to be determined closer to the time?
Yeah, no, what we want to do is, you know, obviously the top-ranked existing athletes are qualified within the individual teams, with the individual events, will be what will determine the teams that qualify. So that will get the team to enter. Then we're leaving it up to the National Olympic Committees to work with the players to nominate what their teams will be, especially those like the US or Japan or Korea, et cetera, who have multiple athletes that will be participating in both the men's and the women's events. So we'll leave that to them to work out who from their country will represent and team up for the mixed team event itself.
It seemed like golf was able to put its best foot forward at Paris 2024. How important was that Olympic Games, not only for the growth of golf, but then to be able to layer in an additional event for 2028?
Yeah, George, it was phenomenal, really. When you think of it, we've only had three Olympic Games. First one was with Zika, second one was COVID, and then we had a proper Olympics. And those that were there and those that watched the telecast, not only just for golf, but across the board, they were fantastic fans. They were fantastic games. And you could see that the players were just rejuvenated by the energy that was around them. You know, not only around the first tee as they teed off, but around the whole of the course. You know, you had a mixture of golf fans plus novices to the event. And that's the beauty of the Olympics. We're opening our sport up and showcasing our sport to a totally larger and new audience. You know, the younger, you know, more neutral in terms of gender, etc. So that's why we're there. And, you know, Paris sort of culminated in showcasing our sport so well. And our athletes, our players performed on that stage. You know, Scottie Scheffler's back nine to chase down John Rahm and to win the gold medal, to me, was phenomenal. And then you have Lydia winning, you know, the full set of medals and the way she performed throughout those 4 days to get that. You know, their performances and the rest of the 120 field that were there on the men's and women's, they showcased the sport and really cemented our position in the Olympic program.
Exciting news for sure. And Lydia, I mean, with the podium slam or Olympic slam, I don't know when we're going to see that again. It was such an amazing final note to the Paris 2024 games with the women's Olympic golf competition.
Not many have done it. You know, it's parallels to what Rory did over the weekend. Who knows? If Rory qualifies for LA, we could have a Rory slam.
Thanks for joining us at Golf Today.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
You know, whenever golf went back in the Olympics, George, the one criticism that seemed to be leveled was the absence of the mixed team event, as though it was a miss. There was also, I guess, some criticism about the format of the 72-hole stroke play, and I think that's dissipated over the years. We've had some terrific final rounds that have kind of weakened that argument. But the absence of the mixed team event, I still thought, was a significant miss. This, I think, is a real win. This is a real kind of grow the footprint of women's golf move here, and we get to watch it on a fantastic golf course at Riviera.
And Anthony hit on it. I mean, 2016, they had Zika. I was there in Rio, went to the opening ceremony, saw part of the men's Olympic golf competition. You had a lot of big names that weren't there. Yep. The Tokyo Games during COVID, a lot of players opting in and out. I always thought 2024 was going to be the litmus test for golf. If you have all the stars playing, showing out and putting on this Olympic stage, a memorable performance, then golf is going to have firm footing going forward. It exceeded my wildest expectations to have Scottie Scheffler get the gold, Lydia Ko get the gold, to then layer in a mixed team event. I think that's going to be a sneaky, huge draw because it's the first time we're going to see a meaningful competition that counts for something that's a mixed team event versus what we've seen kind of end of the year in November, December events that don't actually count for an LPGA Tour or PGA yeah. Tour win.
And we've also seen some of the biggest names in the game get increasingly invested in Olympic golf as we've gone over the last few years. So it should be a great year in 2028 in Los Angeles. But something new is happening on tour this week. Rangefinders in the hands of PGA Tour players. The question is, will it make them get a move on? We'll spend a few minutes on that when we come back.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Some more news today. As part of a continued commitment to address speed of play, the PGA Tour and Korn Ferry Tour will test multiple speed of play recommendations beginning this week. On the PGA Tour, distance measuring devices will be permitted at six events over a four-week period, beginning with this week's RBC Heritage and Corrales Punta Cana Championship going on concurrently, continuing through the Truist Championship and the One Flight Myrtle Beach Classic. Korn Ferry Tour will test distance measuring devices at three consecutive events, beginning with this week's Lecom Suncoast Classic. The use of distance measuring devices is one of three recommendations from the PGA Tour's player-led speed of play working group formed in 2025, which aims to positively impact speed of play in response to survey feedback from the Tour's Fan Forward Initiative. Players who elect to utilize a distance measuring device must ensure the device measures distance only. All other features, such as course mapping, club selection, advice, and measuring slope, elevation, and wind, must be disabled prior to using the device during competition. The penalty for the first breach of this rule is two strokes. A second breach results in disqualification. With more on site at this week's PGA Tour stop, let's send it out to Todd Lewis.
Well, will these distance measuring devices or range finders impact the speed of play on the PGA Tour? Well, we're going to find out, because the PGA Tour has a testing period with six tournaments beginning this week at the Corrales Punta Cana Championship and here at the RBC Heritage on Hilton Head Island. Now, I had a chance to talk to players and caddies about these devices, and they said, yes, it may come in handy when they're off the grid. In other words, in the woods or on another hole. But most players and caddies are going to continue to walk off their yardages. And they are a little skeptical that this is going to have a heavy impact in regards to pace of play.
The pace of play debate is funny. I think, you know, people want to watch exciting golf. I think that's what it's all about. And let's say if we do all these changes and we save 20 minutes off of a round of golf, like, is somebody going to sit down on the couch on Sunday and be like, well, I didn't have 5 hours to watch a round of golf, but I got 4 hours and 40 minutes. Like, now I'm in. And so I think if we're going to spend a lot of our time and energy, I think where I would want to spend it is I want to get more people involved in the game of golf, more people to be able to come play. It's a great game. It's a great sport. And, you know, you learn a lot of life lessons playing golf. And I think what's most important for me as a player, where I want to spend the most time and energy specifically in the game of golf is just getting people involved. You know, I've met some of my best friends in the whole world playing the game of golf, and, you know, it's a really special game that I think more people should want to play.
I think there are going to be times where you'll go through your process. Our process is to walk stuff off, check a sprinkle head, walk it off versus just zapping it. When we're at home, funny enough, you just zap it. So I think if you are, you know, this 18's a good example. If you're on the left edge of the fairway or the right edge of the fairway, that's like 75 yards across. If you take the sort of the middle chunk, and depending on angle, you know, that front edge is going to sit differently. So I think depending on a golf course like this, it actually could help you pick up the pace, just because, you know, you and your caddy can just sit there and laser the pin and then kind of figure out roughly what the angle is versus trying to sit there and, you know, find all the sprinkler heads and then, you know, do a little bit of math equation. So I think it has potential to speed it up, but I don't know if it's going to make a whole lot of difference.
I think it's situational. I think when you have a shot that's way offline, it's certainly going to help speed up that process. I think in terms of going up the fairway, you hit a good shot, I think it's going to not impact pace of play.
Why is that?
Just because everyone has their routines out here in terms of using their yardage book. They're looking constantly at different numbers, what it is to carry certain spots. And with the rangefinder, it's only the most accurate when you shoot the flag. So having our yardage books help us significantly more with understanding, like, kind of pin locations, what's best, the best place to necessarily, like, land the ball, as opposed to a rangefinder just going to shoot the target. So I don't think it's going to impact pace of play at all. It's just going to be very helpful in situations.
I think slow golfers are just slow, and distance measuring devices and shot penalties and all that stuff we're now trying is about 10 months too late, since we've already cut 25 jobs. Why didn't we try this 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
Now, there's another significant testing period happening on the Korn Ferry Tour that starts this week and will last throughout the remainder of the season. They are changing their pace of play policy. Now, what has happened prior to this testing period? Well, let's say a group is slow. Well, the tour and the rules officials will go up to the group and say you're out of position. Then they'll come up again if they're still out of position, say you're on the clock. And then they'll come up to a player and say you've got a bad time. That's a warning. The next bad time, the second bad time, means that you get a one-stroke penalty. What the tour is going to do on the Korn Ferry Tour now is they're going to eliminate that warning. In other words, you get one bad time, you get one-stroke penalty. Two bad times, a two-stroke penalty. Third bad time, you are disqualified from the tournament. This could be implemented on the PGA Tour in the distant future. What's that distance? It's hard to measure. Guys?
Well, we're joined now by Gary Young, who is the PGA Tour Senior Vice President for Rules and Competitions. And Gary, we've just heard from some of your members there who seem to be voicing some skepticism at the possible impact of distance measuring devices. Are you optimistic it is going to give you data that will be decisive in this issue?
Certainly, it was interesting to hear all those different opinions, and that's about what we expected. We're optimistic. The pace of play working group that we had established months ago, this was one of the suggestions that they felt very strongly about would help, certainly on those offline shots. And, you know, maybe when we're in pairs off of one tee and those slower players are struggling to stay up with the group ahead. So in our minds, anything that's going to help impact pace of play positively, why would we hold that back?
Gary, what data have you seen from the PGA Championship since they implemented this, allowing distance measuring devices back in 2021?
Yeah, I have to be honest, I haven't heard much data from the PGA of America. That would be a question for them. But again, the weeks following the PGA Championship, we really didn't get much call from the players and caddies to follow suit that following week. So that sort of tells us that there's a mixture of opinions on it.
Gary, you mentioned that you'd kind of want to do anything to move forward with this issue of pace of play and kind of speed things up out there. Why not just directly target the players? Everyone out there knows who the slow guys are. All the members talk about it all the time. Why not target those guys instead of adding another data gathering device? Because it doesn't sound as though any of these guys are going to move away from pacing off their yardage books at all.
Yeah, well, I guess the whole point is educating everyone on our pace of play policy that does target the slowest of the slow. We keep data on players every week, every shot that's hit, and we are addressing those slowest players through a fine system. Of course, we don't share that right now at this time with the public, but rest assured that those slowest players are accumulating fines and being addressed. The whole idea is to target the 5% slowest players on tour and to get them to change their behavior. And oftentimes we'll say to them, look, the goal here is not to make you a fast player. We're just trying to make you a more average speed player. And we've had good success having meetings with those slowest players, taking a look at what part of their game is hurting them the most, and trying to come up with a good system to try to see how they can save time in those areas.
Gary, the last individual player to receive a stroke penalty was Glenn Day back in 1995. There was a team penalty in 2017 at Zurich. I know there's being testing, like we mentioned, on other satellite tours as far as implementation of a shot penalty. Can you envision a future in the not-too-distant future where that is now once again implemented as a deterrent on the PGA Tour? Because so many guys say, we try everything else. If you start penalizing shots, then you're going to actually see some course correction from these slower players.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the sentiment from the players. We've heard that from many players over the last couple of months. You know, until we get to the point where you guys are penalizing us and assessing stroke penalties, I'm not sure how much is going to change. So obviously, given that sentiment, we made a commitment to test things on the Korn Ferry Tour and PGA Tour of America's first and see how we do at those levels of the sport before we take it to the absolute top of the sport at the PGA Tour level. We've promised the membership that was the process we would have in place. And so it's going to be interesting to see what they find from this test period for the remainder of the year on both of those tours, how many penalties are actually assessed.
Going back to the specific test here this week at the Heritage, Gary, with the distance measuring devices, you've made clear that players will have to turn off any other capabilities on that device, that no one's going to gain an advantage by knowing, for instance, the elevation change on the shot that they face. Is that something you're trusting the players to do, or is there a process for actually making sure that that is the case?
Well, the whole entire game is based on honesty and integrity. So, yes, we do trust that they're going to do the right thing. Most of them have range finders or lasers that they use that have a color-coded, something color-coded on there that shows clearly that the slope feature has been turned on those devices. So I'm not worried too much about that. They all are very familiar with this from their days playing as amateurs and at other levels of the game where distance measuring devices have been allowed for high-level competition. We have spent a lot of time over the course of the last 2 days speaking with players, caddies, making sure that every one of them knows what the penalty structure is and what they can and can't have on that device.
Gary, what's the timeline like, and golf fans are wondering, until you're publicizing bad times for players and making the data that you've accrued internally share it more with the golf world so they have an understanding, okay, who are these guys and what are the metrics in place that they haven't hit?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. That was the third item that came out of this working group, was eventually there was a sentiment that sharing that information, first of all, with their fellow members would probably be a strong deterrent. We just want to make sure that the information and that data, how we present that, we want to try to present that in a very positive manner as well. There's all sorts of statistics that we would like to relate to their performance on the golf course as it relates to speed of play. So we're working on different metrics that we can measure, and more to come on that over the coming months on how we will present that and to what level we'll present that information.
Well, I know we will be following along right here on Golf Channel. He is Gary Young with the PGA Tour. Thank you, Gary.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you for having me.
Paul McGinley joins us now, of course, from the live from set at Augusta National on Sunday night. You were there, Paul, when all of this went down, when Rory McIlroy won the third leg of the Grand Slam back in Liverpool, 2014. You were his Ryder Cup captain later that year. Did you believe that it would take almost 4,000 days to get from leg three to leg four?
No, I don't think you would have got a big bet on that, wouldn't you? Over 10 years. Quite incredible. I think at that time, Eamon, there was a bit of a vacuum in the game. Tiger was coming off the boil. There wasn't a whole lot coming up behind, certainly in the next few years. After Rory won those titles, Jordan came on the scene, Brooks came on the scene, and it became, Dustin Johnson became a whole lot more competitive at the top of that world rankings and challenging for majors. So it's taken himself a bit of a time, but boy, did he make it dramatic when he got there.
It is pretty amazing when you look at all the names who won multiple majors in that gap for Rory from 2014 to 2025. You hit those two. You throw in John Rahm, Xander Schauffele, Colin Morikawa, among others. So there are a lot of guys who had their moment before Rory was able to rise up again. Paul, have you seen a man have to battle himself even more than the rest of the field to close out a major like we saw with Rory?
Yeah, I think that was the backdrop to the whole thing, George, was the human story there. And, you know, we were told on Sky regularly during the week, remember, we're going to have big viewing figures here. A lot of people tune in to watch the golf, are not necessarily golf fans. So make sure you speak to them as well as the golf fan and be aware of the bigger story. So, you know, the bigger story here, which brought people in, is the Hollywood story. And I don't mean Hollywood County Down. I mean the Hollywood California story that they make movies on, which is the human story. And here's a guy over the last 10 years was heavily criticized in so many different ways, particularly in the last couple of years when he's let some opportunity slip to win another major championship. And he took a lot of criticism, a lot of flack, and to come back off the floorboards the way he did, and the way he did it as well. I mean, even in the last round on Sunday, he was on the floor a few times, and somehow he managed to crawl himself up and throw some more punches and get himself to the top of that leaderboard and eventually over the line. I mean, it really was the to and fro's, the human emotions were just unbelievable. And for me, I'm more pleased for Rory the person than I am for Rory the golfer with what's happened here, because I know it was a weight that weighed very heavily on his shoulders. And to finally eradicate that was huge. And it was a big, big release of pressure more than anything else when he got over the line, I'm sure.
Is he the best European ever now, Paul? I mean, he's got the same number of majors as Seve. He's got one less than Faldo, and you competed against both of those guys, but both Seve and Faldo only won two of the four majors at the Masters and the Open Championship. Where is Rory in that European greats firmament now?
Yeah, for me, I'm in the camp of the Grand Slam is something different. It elevates you into a different stratosphere because you set the different exams, Eamon, and there's four different exams, as we know, the Lynx golf courses that you play the Open Championship on, and you got to have a certain skill set for that with the bounciness and the style of the architecture, the US Open and the heavy rough, the PGA, which is a little bit more difficult than a normal PGA Tour event. And then you got the Masters and all the charm and the history that's associated. So it's a very different skill set to be able to sit all four exams, and only, you know, two players now in 59 years have done that, and one being Tiger, now being Rory. So for me, that sits above the likes of Nick, who's got six majors. The Grand Slam is something special, and I'm so thrilled that Rory has kind of achieved all together. Not alone has he won a major again, not alone has he won the Masters, but he's completed the Grand Slam. God, it's that for me is a big pressure release valve, and we could well see him go on now to play and win more majors and add to that tally now that big pressure and weight has been lifted from his shoulders.
Is Rory playing the best golf of his career right now compared to 2014?
I think he's a more rounded player than he's ever been before. I think Brad Faxon's been a great addition to his putting. I think he's a better putter than he's ever been before. Brad has married in the quickness of what he plays and the creativity of what he plays to doing the same in his putting, and that's been a great marriage. I think Bob Rotella's had a big influence. We got the pointy elbows back again. He was a man on a mission on Sunday. Bryson has talked about him not talking to him on the way around. That's an example of the pointy elbows. You know, hitting the shots like a second shot to 15 on Saturday. The minute he hit it, he walks after it with a look on his face, not being over exuberant after he hit great shots over the 4 days. It's another example of the pointy elbows, the focus that was required. So I think he's in a great place mentally. He's a more rounded player, and he's a better wedge player than he's ever been before. I think the movement to the spin of your ball with TaylorMade has been really important for him, as he's able to hit those shots in lower but still have flight and spin on them at the same time. And I think that's been really good for his distance control. We saw that at Pebble Beach, probably the most difficult place to hit control wedge shots anywhere in the world, because the greens are soft and the greens slope from high from back to left. And the number of shots that he hit in there, very either stiff or very close, was great to see, and showed you that his wedge play is improved enormously. So for all of those reasons, I think he's a more rounded golfer. He's got more skills to his armory, and you can see that in the fact that he won the TPC, not being on his best game, not being on his A game. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, we would have said, well, Rory had to be on his best in order to win. Now Rory doesn't have to be on his best. He's not one-dimensional in terms of relying on his driving. Strokes gains shows that he used to have a 67% reliance on his driver. Now that's down to as little as 30%. So that shows you that other parts of his game are making up for it. So we have the stats to back up that he is a more rounded player than he's ever been before.
Certainly the two biggest events we've seen this year, he's won both of them, and it's not unreasonable to say he won them in a less than pretty manner when it counted. Paul, you're also with Leek Donald as part of the Ryder Cup team this year. You got to be feeling pretty cocky at this stage of the year with all the success you're seeing from your team.
Never cocky, Eamon. Never cocky. We know the challenge that lies ahead in New York. We know how difficult that environment is going to be to play in. We know it's going to take certain personalities to play in that. And yes, the form is good for Europeans early season, and we wish the Ryder Cup was in the next 2 or 3 weeks, but that's not the case. We've got to hold this form. We've got to hold the mindset of the players for another, 5 months until that Ryder Cup. So we're not counting our chickens, and we know how difficult it's going to be. It's going to be still a very, very formidable American team. And there's no doubt that the likes of Scotty and Xander, who have not shown their best form so far this season, are going to get better as the season goes on and probably be in the prime of their season when it comes to September. So it's a long season. And yes, we've come out of the gates quick. And the key now is to try to hold this form for the next 4 or 5 months.
we had fellow Irishman Padraig Harrington on the show yesterday, and he was talking about Bryson DeChambeau, and he said, I was so surprised that Bryson changed his style of play in that final round at Augusta National. The specific example he gave was on the third, laying back off the tee instead of blasting driver up there. And he said that Bryson was at Pinehurst. There's no way he wouldn't have hit driver with a one-shot lead. What do you think?
I think Patrick's absolutely right. And the stats, again, will back it up. He was the best in the short game all week. He was the seventh best off the tee. And there is two skill sets. He was 51st in iron play out of 54 players. So his weakness was his iron. So to lay it up to hit an iron shot in didn't make any sense when his two skills for the week were going to be short game and driving. So, Patrick is right. He had the initiative at that time. There's twos and fros in a round of golf. There's big moments in tournaments. And he had seized the initiative on the first two holes through Rory's double bogey in the first and then not making bogey in the second. Bryson had seized the initiative there at that stage, and he handed it back with that play as he made bogey, and Rory went on to make birdie, and then Rory stood up in the next tee with the honour and hit a magnificent, four or five iron in there, one of the best shots of the day into the fourth. So there was twos and fros all the way around, and that was surprising. I think Patrick's right with that point. It was a good point to make.
How big a part of what happened at the weekend do you think Harry Diamond was, Paul? Because we've seen over the last few years, Harry's come in certainly for a lot of criticism, and Rory has pretty stoutly defended him at every turn. Yeah. This idea of having your friend be your caddy. But, you know, Harry was also a pretty accomplished amateur player in Ireland as well. He's clearly a big part of that team.
I think so, and I think he's a really good caddy for Rory. I mean, he mightn't be the best caddy for everybody else, but he certainly is for Rory. I give the example of Billy Foster in Europe, and when Billy caddied for Darren Clark, it was micromanaging, and that's what Darren needed. And Billy saw the shots and then said, do you see this shot? Do you see that shot? And Darren would go, yeah, I do see that shot. Okay, well, let's play it with this shot and knock it down or play it up or whatever the case may be. And that was a great marriage because they kind of were on the same path and they spoke so visually to each other. Rory is very much his own man in everything he does. You'll know that as well as anybody, Eamon. His personality right down to how he plays the game. And one of the great things about him is he never blames anybody else when it goes wrong. But at the same time, it's important that he gets the credit when it goes right. And I think one of the things that was really important, and I read it, I haven't spoken to Rory, so I'm not sure on this, but I read about it. And if this is what he said, if this is what he said to Rory going down to the playoff, this was brilliant. Going into a playoff, it's all about reset. It's all about, okay, I've just made a mistake. Where am I going to get my mind back into the right headspace to hit my tee shot down this playoff hole? And when they got into the cart, Harry said to him, he said, you'd have taken this, wouldn't you? Sitting in a cart on the way down to a playoff hole on Monday morning. And Rory said, absolutely right. I would have done that. And that's the kind of thing that rebuilds a mindset. I remember something similar playing with Patrick in the Ryder Cup. Patrick had played in the morning. He played poorly. He wasn't full of confidence going out in the second round. We were playing against Tiger. We were playing against Davis, 1-3 in the world. Tiger right in his pomp. We lost the first hole. We lost the second hole. We're not looking very good. And I remember saying to Patrick going to the third tee box, I tell you what, I said, let's give ourselves double bogey in that first hole. Let's give ourselves par in the second. Rather than being two down after two, let's say that we're two over par, and let's now play against the golf course and see if we can break par. And whatever happens after that happens. And Patrick immediately looked at me and he goes, it was almost like came out of his slumber and he goes, that's a great idea. Let's do that. So they're the kind of things that can happen in a round of golf, and mindset is so important. And sometimes you hit the nail on the head and it brings people into the right mindset. Sometimes it doesn't. And if that's what Harry said to him, that was the right thing to say at the right time, because Rory had just made a mess of a second shot into 18. Arguably, maybe that was a worse shot than the shot he hit into 13 from 125 with a wedge to win the Masters, a wedge and two putts to then block it into the bunker. So you can imagine where his head was at. And for the reset to happen so quickly, to stand in that tee box then in the playoff was brilliant, particularly with Justin having had the honour and hit it down the fairway. To Rory stand up after him and hit it even further down the middle of the fairway, that was brilliant.
He was on his front foot in that playoff. And before exactly. I let you go, we got an Irishman here. I got one sitting next to me. Who do you think was more giddy in celebrating Rory McIlroy's victory, Paul, you or Eamon?
Eamon's always the giddiest, no matter what's going on. If it's a negative, he's very giddy. And if it's a positive, he gets very giddy too. So no matter what the scenario, he likes to get giddy.
I think he's talking about Irish sentimentality, and I think you're always going to win that argument, Paul. Paul, always that good is. To be with you.
All right. Welcome, guys. Good to chat to you too. Bye-bye.
We got more golf today after this. Several years ago, Pasatiempo leadership made the decision to hire Jim Urbina to restore the original Alistair Mackenzie greens, putting surfaces that had been touched by almost a century of sand splash, runoff, top dressing, and countless other influences and architects. And in April of 2023, they started with the front nine. 7 months later, and after reopening to members and the general public, it was deemed a huge success. A day after last year's Western Intercollegiate, it was on to the back nine.
In order to better understand what has been done to every green at Pasatiempo, we're focusing in on the 16th green. More than 12 feet of elevation change from back to front, and with three distinct tiers to that green, it's notorious for being one of the most diabolical putting surfaces in the world of golf.
We don't want to flatten it out. We don't want to make it vanilla. Nobody wants to go to Baskin Robbins and have vanilla ice cream. You want to have flavors. And we have to make sure the 16th hole, like all the other 17 greens at Pasatiempo, have some flavor. We can't make it vanilla.
From peeling back what they referred to as the fat, they excavated with shovels, consulted an archive of images. They restored lost pin placements, and in this case, bumps and punch bowls. They modernized the irrigation, and then made final tweaks and edits before seeding, watering, and mowing.
You know, you do a project, you have your site, you have your architect, you have a contractor, you got a superintendent and an agronomic crew, and they all have to marry together. And usually one of them doesn't marry very well, and it makes projects a little bit more difficult to execute. But in this case, we had all the right players.
And on December 5th, 2024, 599 days after the members gathered on April 16th, 2023, to close the front nine for the first half of the restoration, they gathered again to reopen the back nine. What was the first foursome in 1929, Cyril Talley, Marion Hollins, Bobby Jones, and Glenna Collette, was now Roger Maltby, Kay Cockrell, Aaron Oberholzer, and Julie Inkster, all who have had a long relationship with the course and the club. Mandon cut the ribbon, and Urbina was on hand to walk along and watch the golf.
We did the right thing. We did the right thing. We did what we had to do to make sure that this place is sustainable for the next 50 years, because it wasn't sustainable. And I think we not only did the right thing from a sustainability standpoint, but Jim did the right thing artistically to bring these greens back to what they're supposed to be, which is they're still Pasatiempo greens. If you're above the pin, you're still gonna struggle at Pasatiempo. And I think that's what's really important, is we not only did the right thing from a sustainability standpoint, but from an architectural standpoint, I think Jim hit it out of the park.
I'm happy that we were successful. This is a golf course that Mackenzie died on. It's not just another afterthought of a golf course of the 90 or 100 he did. He died here, and he lived here, and he dreamed here, and he all of his life ended right here. So you have to be a little bit guarded because of what the story of Pasatiempo is about and what it tells about Marion Hollins, a World Golf Hall of Famer, and Alistair Mackenzie. You have to be guarded. I apologize for that, but you have to be guarded.
Right now, I wouldn't do anything different, but I think that takes time. But standing here right now on the 16th hole, I can't think of anything I'd change.
Man, documenting that story with this Now Golf Channel contributor, Matt Janella. Matt, I know you're a West Coast guy. You grew up a relatively short drive from Pasatiempo. What was it like to be able to see this renovation up close?
Good to be with you, George. Eamon, it was special, to say the least. I think, you know, I've been covering
Pasta Tiempo since back in 2014, 2015 with the Golf Channel. When we did Water Week in 2015, the story was, is Pasta Tiempo going to be able to survive? I mean, they had a serious water issue. They were trying to figure out how they were going to actually, you know, keep the golf course open in a very famous, you know, moment in history. They were out of water, and they made a deal with Scotts Valley, and they got some reclaimed water, and they built their own water treatment facility. And here we are, you know, essentially 10 years later, and we got this beautiful golf course, the Western Intercollegiate, the best players, you know, at the college level playing at a McKinsey original where public can actually, you know, rock up and play this golf course. And all that's happened since that moment in which they were you know, trying to figure out their resources as it relates to water, to what is now a 2-year project of restoring these greens that were in desperate need of some TLC. I just think it's going to be something that's going to be analyzed, assessed, commended, and celebrated for decades to come.
Heard Jim Urbina say that no one goes to Baskin Robbins, just gets vanilla. There are different flavors, like the green complexes we see at Pasta Tiempo. Get us into the 16th and the work they did on that green.
So we have a 2-part docuseries, 30 minutes of content at PastaTiempo.com, where you can really actually see, and you saw little bits of it there, where how they, you know, dug down. They went back to ultimately trying to figure out what their future is going to be. And I think, you know, Jim Urbina and Justin Mandan, the superintendent there, Earth Sculptures, the contractors that worked with the agronomy team and Urbina on doing this work, Earth Sculpture is very familiar with McKinsey work. They're familiar with working off of a set of images as reference points. Urbina took, you know, months to just simply do the 16th. I mean, this was years in the making, and then, you know, months that he worked on, you know, every green, but 16 in particular, 18, 5, 8, 3. Some of those greens out there, the elevation change from top to bottom of this property itself, and then the 16th green in particular, talking about a multi-tiered green. In order to pull that off, it had to be thoughtful. And the team that Jim Urbina surrounded himself with, and the people that are, you know, experts in their field, and what they were doing and how they did it. It's like I said, this is going to go down in history because it's McKinsey, because it's Pasta Tiempo, because you have Marion Hollins, another World Golf Hall of Famer who's very, you know, obviously developed this club and this land. This will go down as one of the great restorations of one of the courses that you and I can play ever.
And you mentioned Marion Hollins. She was such an important figure there with Pasta Tiempo, with Cypress Point. How was she influential then with Augusta National as well?
I just think all of this goes to Augusta National. We know that Bobby Jones lost in the first round of the U.S. Amateur at Pebble Beach in 1929, right? And we know Bobby Jones is looking to try to build a golf course at that time, he goes over and plays Cypress Point, a McKinsey design that, you know, Rayner had originally routed. But I think you and I could have done a decent routing at Cypress Point, George. Like, I think, you know, we're talking about a pretty incredible piece of property. He comes over and Bobby Jones comes over and plays opening day at Pasta Tiempo in 1929. You're talking about an inland golf course with a massive a change of elevation from top to bottom of that property. 250 feet, by the way, from the top of the property of Pasta Tiempo, that 12th tee, 11th green, all the way down to the second green. Augusta National, first green to 11th green, is 148 feet. So almost 100 feet more elevation change top to bottom from Pasta Tiempo to Augusta. I think that it was actually, Cypress Point had an impact on him. But Pasta Tiempo, another inland golf course, you're going to have to work around, you know, some water, wild elevation change. I think it's Pasta Tiempo that ultimately got McKinsey the job for Clifford Roberts and Bobby Jones at Augusta National. And Marion Hollins, who McKinsey worked with very closely and trusted with his project at Augusta. Actually sent Marion Hollins on one trip where Mackenzie couldn't go, and Marion Hollins went out and assessed some of the work being done at Augusta National on behalf of Alistair Mackenzie. So I think you're going to see a lot more events at Paso Tiempo and beyond the Western Intercollegiate. I think it's very probable and possible that a high-level women's event is going to be played at Paso Tiempo, and deservedly so. And I think that's going to continue to bring Marion Hollins, who now is a World Golf Hall of Famer, the attention and recognition that she has always deserved but continues to deserve.
Yeah, very rightfully deserves. Matty G, we could sit around and talk all day, but we got to say goodbye. Appreciate you stopping by Golf Today.
Love being on with you. I can talk Paso Tiempo forever, and I'm really looking forward to watching tomorrow's round.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.